5 o'clock somewhere.
It's the stories trending now in sports. Right here. Right here. On 1320 KFAN.
Five.
Jamal Williams turns the corner. He's already got three touchdowns tonight. And Jamal Williams has number four.
Governor Ben, the top five and five, the five biggest stories in sports today in the state of Utah. He's Kyle Gunther. I'm Ben Anderson. And the big story is Jamal Williams. He makes NFL.com's list of the five running backs with the most to prove at the upcoming NFL Combine. It kicks off a week from yesterday, February 28th.
Jamal Williams, with a track background, cannot have a poor 40 time. Otherwise, that nullifies one of the big feathers in his cap. He also has a bit of an injury history, but when you watch Jamal Williams in the fourth quarter, he's always running with more violence than he had in the first quarter. That's what you want out of a running back. That's what you see in guys that used to play the position back when there was a lead running back, but there's not that type of guy anymore. There's not a need for that anymore for most NFL teams. If you don't have Todd Gurley, no, you just use a running back by committee. You have Thunder and Lightning with LeGarrette Blount and Deion Lewis like they have in New England. There's not a need for a feature back. However, Jamal Williams is that true guy who can get up to 220 pounds and carry the ball 30 times a game. He just might be a bit outdated. That position might not exist anymore in the NFL. You need an immediate fire starter. You need lightning in a can, and Jamal Williams has got to prove that he's got that with the 40 time. But because when you talk about the way someone is evaluated on film, understand that Bill Belichick is not sitting down and scouting college recruits. He's watching film at times of guys that are just elite finalists for a pick. If it's coming down to a really hairy decision, Bill Belichick might get involved there, but he's way too busy dealing with other issues, dealing with schematic issues of the current team. So a guy like Jamal Williams is evaluated by the scouting department, which means scouts are watching him on film, as they've done for many decades in a lot of cases, but they're trying to tell your speed based on what you look like on film. It's an inexact science.
This is from,
so Jamal needs to show that some of that is worthwhile and just put up a good 40 time.
This is from Chad Reuter at NFL.com, who has Jamal as the fifth running back who needs to prove the most at the upcoming NFL Combine. He says, Jamal Williams' 40-yard dash time might be one of the most important of any player at the Combine. There's no question he has the physicality as a runner, nor his willingness to be a workhorse. He looks like he's able to get moving fast enough to leave college defenders in the dust, but what about veteran linebackers and safeties that he'll have to face at the next level? Displaying pure speed in the 40 as well as above-average agility in other areas could earn him a late second-round draft grade.
The issue, too, is that Jamal didn't catch the ball a ton at BYU. Part of that is Taysom Hill just wasn't comfortable with that role. He was a guy that would throw to his first option at receiver, or he would take off and run. There wasn't a lot of checkdowns for Jamal Williams, right. And so that'll be different at the next level, but there's just not a lot of film out there of him doing that, so Jamal must catch the ball well at the Combine. The Combine's coming up next week, and it is the most over-criticized, over-publicized set of underwear Olympics ever, but it gives you a concrete number to point to. Jamal Williams is listed at 6'2", 220 at BYU. Well, he's not. He's 6 foot, and he was 211 pounds at the Senior Bowl. I'm sure that Jamal was trying to slim down a bit to run well. And also, you know, Jamal might have cleaned up his diet. Jamal's talked very openly about how he's young and vivacious, and he doesn't have to focus on eating anything. He just eat whatever he wants. Well, he never had any body fat. But if all of a sudden he cleans up his diet from eating 12 pieces of cake a week to all of a sudden eating leafy vegetables and steak sandwiches, maybe you'll see Jamal lean out a bit. He doesn't need to be fat, but he needs to be over 220 pounds, I think, to be the ideal role of a running back that a team wants him to play in the NFL.
If he can get that third round grade, I feel very confident Jamal. I think he's going to get drafted. I do think Jamal ends up getting drafted here. But if he gets that third round grade, I think you're very confident he has a great shot to make an NFL team. If he falls below that, he ends up in that fourth, fifth round, sixth round type of back, it's just so hard to make the NFL. And even if you're drafted late in rounds like that as a running back, where they will come in and say, no, we'll just take another guy. We'll just take another undrafted player, because there are so many good running backs at the college level. There's just no guarantees if you're selected after those top couple of rounds. And that's what's going to be hard for Jamal. If he gets in on that first or second day, obviously he's not going to be a first day draft pick and likely not a second day. But if he can be early third day draft pick, he's going to be in really good shape. Otherwise, he's got to do what every other running back does, and that's going out and fighting for his job.
Who are the top teams that Jamal's played against, though? I mean, who's the top competition? He looked really good at times against teams that BYU's put in front of him.
He looked great against Michigan State.
I think it was Virginia a couple of years ago. Yeah, Michigan State this year.
He got hurt against Utah, and he struggled against UCLA.
Jamal Williams hasn't had the stiffest of competition to go up against. So there is that ahead of him when it comes to evaluating him from an NFL standpoint. But that's why the 40 time is so important for him. I think he'll bulk up afterwards. I think Garrett Bowles has an immense amount of attention on him as well from Utah. The tackle he's a freak of nature. So if he only comes out and runs a good 40 time, then teams will say, well, he's a bit raw. Maybe I don't need him in the first round. But if Garrett Bowles comes out and runs a 4.8 40 or a 4.9 40, teams will project him to be in the top 15 or 20 picks, which means if you're selected there, you're expected to be a Pro Bowler. So imagine what those expectations are. If Garrett Bowles plays 1 year of college football, gets drafted in the first round, and then all of a sudden becomes a starting left tackle and the NFL becomes an instant millionaire, imagine what a meteoric rise that is for the young man.
It's also a very good running back class when we go back to talking about Jamal Williams. So we'll see. A team could fall in love with him and take him in the third round. You saw Devontae Booker get passed up a couple of times where people said he might be drafted as early as the second round. He fell to the fourth round. No, he had some issues. He was coming off a major injury at Utah. He never ran a 40 time. He never showed up in any combines. He didn't run at Utah's pro day. So there were some issues there with Devontae Booker, but at least teams before got to get an update on what his health looked like. There aren't those major questions for Jamal Williams right now, and I think that's a huge plus for him going into the draft. And again, the combine's going to be really important for him.
Number four.
Can't wait a year. You know, injuries, egos, you know, whatever can happen. Split seconds. So, Boston, I don't know. I don't know if they can get Butler, if they can get George, you know, even if George is available now.
Peter Vesey joined us earlier on the show, longtime NBA insider, breaking down the NBA trade deadline. Jazz names been thrown around quite a bit. Shelvin Mack to the Cavaliers still sounds like it has some legs, though that's not going to change anyone's future, the Jazz or the Cavs. The interesting name that popped up late last night from Tim McMahon and Mark Stein at ESPN was that the Jazz might be exploring a trade for Deron Williams, and today both Deron Williams and Andrew Bogut were held out of practice, which does kind of provide some legs that the Mavericks are looking at trading those two guys with former Utah ties.
Well, now the counter to that is that these rumors leaked from Dallas, because the Jazz are a tight-knit organization. Information doesn't leak out on accident from the Utah Jazz. Now, maybe the Jazz wanted to gauge a little bit of the fan response, and so far I'd say it was mostly positive. I would say most fans responded favorably to the idea of D-Will coming back. There are some questions of how he actually fits in. I mean, does he start over George Hill? Because D-Will's been a starter this year. George Hill doesn't want to come off the bench, or he's certainly not going to re-sign with the Jazz long-term if they've brought in D-Will to beat him out.
Right.
But I think Dallas is clearly fed up with D-Will. They see the ceiling with him. Deron Williams is a different player than he was 5 years ago when he was last playing with the Jazz. What has it been, 6 years now? I mean, it's been a long time, and he's a different player. I love the idea of mending fences and rebuilding bridges. I'm not sure it makes a ton of sense. I'm not sure the Jazz are really all that willing to get involved. Although the Jazz were shopping Derek Favors, or maybe vice versa. Teams were coming after Derek Favors. I'm not sure the Jazz ever got the offer they wanted, but
at least not yet. Again, and we'll see. There's 24, a little less than 24 hours now. It's at 1 p.m. tomorrow is the trade deadline. We'll see. Teams get desperate and start to add more, or some teams start to realize, you know what, we did our shopping, we looked around, the market's not for us. You'll see some trades be made, and we'll see when some of those dominoes start to fall. If a team said, you know what, we are all in, and these two players are totally different, so don't lean on this a ton. But let's say a team is all in on getting another big man, and they're going to say, we're going to go after Jahlil Okafor, from the Philadelphia 76ers. And if we can't get him, who's number two on our board?
Maybe it's Derek Favors.
Maybe it's Derek Favors. And they say, yeah, he's not the offensive juggernaut that we think Okafor can turn into, but he's a better all-around player. He's a little bit older. Maybe his ceiling isn't as high. But we had a first-round draft pick that we were waiting to send out in addition to a borderline starting player to get Jahlil Okafor, and we'll happily pay that price for Derek Favors. And if that was the case, I think the Jazz would certainly look into a deal like that. And there's still time left for this to be done. It's easier, and looking at the Dallas Mavericks, whose whole goal right now is to get a better draft pick coming up here in June, it's easier to get worse at the trade deadline than it is to get better. It's easier if you're on that side where you're saying, you know what, let's give up these last 30 games, let's work on rebuilding this offseason, getting a better asset in our draft pick, and maybe we can add another draft pick to it by trading an Andrew Bogut or trading a Darren Williams. That's really easy to do, and we've seen the Jazz do that in the past. It's much harder when you have a good team who's competing for home court advantage in the first round to go out and then make a move that makes you even more competitive. And that's why I like Lou Williams' trade yesterday by the Houston Rockets. I think they got better.
Well, the Rockets did, and the Jazz aren't necessarily in this position where they've got everything clicking. The Jazz sputtered a bit late down the stretch before the trade deadline, and the Jazz have money to spend just to get to the salary cap floor. That's the issue.
Yeah.
You know, if the Jazz's response is just that, we can't find enough players here, well, that's not good enough. I mean, you should at least fill out the actual roster to the fullest extent of your financial capabilities, and that's why I think there are so many people waiting with bated breath on what the Jazz are going to do. But also, the Jazz have done this for each of the last 4 years, found ways to get themselves in the headlines without ever actually making a move. If going out and getting Shelvin Mack was kind of a strange admittance because everyone else's third stringer shouldn't have shown up and had such a positive impact on your squad. Yeah, now it might be time to move on, but Dante Exum still has a future. Trey Lyles still has a future with this team. At least that's what we were told before, but this is all a conflagration of a number of different storylines that are only about keeping Gordon Hayward in town this offseason, if and when he opts out and takes a look at other teams. If Boston lands Paul George or if Boston lands Jimmy Butler, though, they're going to be out of the Gordon Hayward sweepstakes.
And that's the nice thing. If you're a Jazz fan, that's something I would root for down the stretch here. First of all, anything happening on the eastern side of the NBA doesn't have a huge effect on the Jazz, unless, of course, it does end up with Boston landing a star small forward, either in the name of Jimmy Butler or Paul George, as they've both been linked to today. If they can make that move, the number one contender for Gordon Hayward's services outside of the Jazz probably falls off the map this offseason. He would then go out and he'd probably interview with Indiana if they traded Paul George, or he'd interview with Chicago if they traded Jimmy Butler, because they'll have money and they're semi-big markets, or his hometown market that he'd be interested in. The Lakers could certainly get involved, as apparently they're after Paul George and Jimmy Butler as well.
I think the Lakers are the number one candidate if, in fact, they make a legit offer to Gordon Hayward this offseason. I think Gordon would consider doing that. Otherwise, I'm more and more convinced that Gordon is going to stick around with the Jazz for the long term. He's now done it all that he can, at least with the Jazz. He's not won a championship, but he made the All-Star team. They're going to make the playoffs this year. That's what he wanted. Now, I'm not sure if he goes to Chicago even to replace Jimmy Butler, let's say, that they can make a deep playoff run there either. You still got to deal with LeBron in the East. You got to deal with Steph Curry in the West. I mean, there's similar Mount Rushmores to climb.
I don't think Gordon Hayward wants to go to a directionless team. And that's the nice thing about Boston. They clearly have a direction. They're one of the best teams in the East. They might have the number one overall pick this year, and they didn't have to give up anything to get it. That's why Boston's a contender, but it's also why Boston does want to go out right now and add a guy who could push them over the cliff, because there's a weird lull in the Eastern Conference. LeBron is tired. The Cavs don't look as good as they did last year, and they don't look like they have this ace up their sleeve at the trade deadline to make themselves considerably better. The East is relatively wide open, at least as open as it's been since LeBron hit his peak, and if you can add a Jimmy Butler or a Paul George, you might become the favorite to face off against the Golden State Warriors in the finals.
Number three.
Big Pac-12 coaching movement in the offseason. ESPN did a nice write-up on all the coaching names. I think I just forgot how many teams absolutely retooled an entire side of the football. Now, a lot of them were in the Pac-12 North. Cal had to retool. They got a new head coach. Oregon had to retool. They got a new head coach. If you look at Arizona, they lost their entire defense.
Arizona and Arizona State had to make major changes, but Arizona's defense has been bad for so long. Rich Rod finally gave up on it. His longtime buddy, his ex-defensive coordinator, is out because Arizona could never get the bodies on the defensive line to progress themselves from a scheme standpoint, and that's not going to change overnight. Arizona and Arizona State are looking for their quarterback identity. They've got guys that are running threats out there. They can't throw the football. Arizona and Arizona State have a long road to get back to actual relevancy. And then you think about the talent at UCLA, and you would assume that they've got it all figured out. But UCLA now just hired their third offensive coordinator in as many years for Josh Rosen. That is so tough for a young guy to fight through. Different styles, different expectations. Josh Rosen's going to be a dynamic NFL player, but he's going to be swimming with his new offensive coordinator, Jed Fish, as they get some new terminology underneath them.
Nope. Arizona.
I said the players' heads are going to be swimming out there.
Arizona Jed State Fish. Lost both of their coordinators. They brought in two new offensive coordinators. They'll do the co-offensive coordinator thing, it looks like. At least they'll have a passing game coordinator and a true offensive coordinator. They also lost their defensive coordinator, who they had to replace. Colorado lost their defensive coordinator. As you mentioned, UCLA had to replace their offensive coordinator and almost that entire staff. USC had very little turnover, which I think will be beneficial for them. And why would you? You've got Sam Darnold. Clay Helton can pretty much do whatever he wants, and I think it's going to look good. Now, Utah obviously made a switch at offensive coordinator as well, moving on from Aaron Roderick. They moved Jim Harding over to assistant head coach or associate head coach, and then brought in Troy Taylor. But that turnover isn't going to be unique. There's going to be a lot of teams facing an uphill battle as far as installing major offensive changes.
Well, and that's why I think Troy Williams is really going to be fighting for his starting job with Cooper Bateman here throughout spring. Utah's going to be careful not to make that announcement publicly. They don't want to ruffle the feathers of any of their future recruits, but Cooper Bateman, if he's got the touch on the underneath routes, he could easily beat out Troy Williams. Troy Williams was good last year, but not great. Now there's an entirely new system. Utah's going to be trying to throw the ball all over the place, but they can only do that at the behest of their defense. Utah's not going to be willing to wear out its own defense. They're not going to be trying to win games 54-48 there. Utah's going to have to figure it out by the first month of the season. Otherwise, there's just not going to be the freedom for Troy Taylor to implement this new wide-open system, because that's what every coordinator's always tried to do, is implement a wide-open system attacking all areas of the field.
Number two.
The key is just getting guys in space, and no one else has ever thought of that, Kyle.
Every coordinator says that. Oh, man, I want to get guys out in space. Let the playmakers make plays. Everybody says that.
Speaking of playmakers making plays, Jimmer has been lighting up the CBA. That's the Chinese Basketball Association. And now, with the Chinese Basketball League quickly coming to an end and Jimmer's wife having a baby, he is back in the States and may be looking for a return to the NBA. I'm sure Jimmer wants to come back, and we'll talk about this with Jackson Emery coming up in about 50 minutes, former BYU Cougar and teammate of Jimmer. He'll give us a breakdown of what he thinks Jimmer wants to do. But even if Jimmer wants to come back, I know he just scored 70 points in China. That doesn't necessarily mean that anyone in the NBA wants Jimmer back. He's not an NBA player. He's never proven it in the past. I don't know what getting 25 shots a game in China is going to do to change anyone's mind.
But the issue is that he was once a lottery pick, and you don't see guys who are drafted that high all of a sudden fall off the map. You could argue that he should have been drafted farther back, but you know, are the Kings truly that naive of a front office that they misevaluated Jimmer by 40 draft spots? I find that hard to believe. I think Jimmer's got a skill set shooting the ball that is world class. The problem is he can't defend anyone. He's not fast enough in certain cases, and no one's going to let you just roam freely and take 30 shots a night. That's not the way it works in the NBA. But there's clearly a value for this guy. And some NBA teams will tell you that the off the court popularity doesn't help Jimmer's case, but he's such a unique player, such a unique enigma. He's certainly making a lot of money overseas, but I think you're right. I think the NBA ship has sort of sailed on Jimmer. He gave it the best shot he could, but you know, there's nothing wrong with being paid millions of dollars in Chinese professional leagues.
Absolutely
He's only got to be there for a few months. You know, Jimmer, though, is driving this train. You know, he feels like he should be back in the NBA. He's not been slighted. I mean, he's been evaluated by six different coaching staffs.
And really good head coaches.
Tom Thibodeau. I mean, everybody had a look at him. Greg Popovich saw him. Yeah, New Orleans saw him. Sacramento saw him. My goodness. I mean, Jimmer's been evaluated. I've always said this. Jimmer's biggest problem was he had too big a feet. Size 14 shoes for Jimmer.
Not that big.
Number one.
I'm like everyone else here, saddened that the negative attention that has been brought to our great university by the seriousness of this case. I feel terrible for our players and our staff who will have to handle the consequences for the actions of a very few.
That's Hugh Freeze, head coach of Ole Miss. Hugh Freeze, you're the one who's lost control here. That's why your team's getting punished. It's lack of institutional control of a team that you're the head coach of. Now, I know you haven't been the head coach for 1,000 years, but these are still allegations that happen mostly under your watch at Ole Miss.
The allegations stem from Laramie Tunsil's stepfather opening the door on some conversations and some details. Well, we've since learned that there's even more allegations. The NCAA has investigated that at least one recruit who didn't even end up signing with Ole Miss was given $15,000 from a booster from Ole Miss. Now, the NCAA is going to come out and say the same thing they did with Cam Newton, say, oh, well, we can't directly prove all this, but we're pretty sure this happened. Look, where there's smoke, there's fire. If it looks and acts like a duck, it's definitely an egg sandwich. Ole Miss has been paying guys just like Alabama, allegedly, and Ohio State and Clemson.
Michigan.
I thought, Michigan probably. I thought it was $500 or $600 at a time. It sounds like it's way more than that. It sounds like it's duffel bag men. It sounds like it's thousands of dollars to a kid who's not even going to commit to your school. And that's my issue. If I'm a booster and I have untold amounts of wealth, I'm willing to give a kid a cash payment to come to my school if that's my cup of tea. But it better work. If I give you $15K and that linebacker
and you
goes,
beat me at Alabama?
Well, then I have to play against you?
Yeah.
Guess what? The next time that assistant coach calls me and asks for $15K, I'm not answering.
Ole Miss has imparted a bowl ban on themselves this upcoming season. Now, missing one game seems bad enough, and it's embarrassing, and maybe some seniors will transfer out if they want to have a chance to compete for something. But really, the harm comes from missing out on all of the postseason money that you get that's split between the SEC conference, and that's estimated to be about $8 million this year. So not only are you losing your $1 million appearance, but all the money that gets split up in revenue from these bowl appearances will not go to Ole Miss coming up this season.
But if you're asking yourself as an Ole Miss fan, was it worth it? The answer is yes. Absolutely. These bozos at the NCAA cannot keep track of all these improprieties. Remember, these are the allegations the NCAA found out about. $13,000 to $15,000 cash payments. What's really going on? You don't believe that's the whole story, do you?
Yeah, the one guy, they caught him.
That's the one dude.
One dude, we caught him perfectly.
He's a bad apple, man.
Coming up next, we look more at Jamal Williams' draft stock and the importance of the combine. I'm talking about the latest trade rumors with the Utah Jazz. Stay tuned. Gunther and Ben.
On 1320 KFAN.
Gunther and Ben in the app.
Gunther and Ben, 1320K fan, 527. He's Kyle Gunther. I'm Ben Anderson. A very happy Wednesday.
Huge news globally. Scientists at NASA have discovered at least 7 new planets that are within 40 light years of us. At least three of these planets are in the Goldilocks zone. That means that they are warm enough and or not cold enough.
Far enough from the sun to be habitable. What is the word?
Habitable.
Habitable?
It's a habitable region
but
around a star.
So far that you can't live there.
No, there are at least now 3 planets that they think are within the Goldilocks zone. They found 7 new planets that they think are Earth-sized planets hovering a nearby dwarf star. These were not visible until very recently. I'm assuming this pretty much means aliens.
Well, I mean, that's what you're looking for, the Goldilocks zone, as you mentioned. I always thought it was just the golden zone. But, yeah, the ability to be in a spot that has similar environment to the Earth.
Well, and speaking of these new planets just discovered, in honor of one of the most popular NBA players' recent opinions, Kyrie Irving came out of the Cleveland Cavaliers and let us all know that he's a flat earther. And if you haven't read into the flat earth movement, oh, you should. It's an interesting one.
It's nonsense.
It's a valid one.
Bizarre nonsense.
It's a valid group.
Magellan disproved it 150, 500 years ago.
What did Magellan know? He didn't have no telescope. He didn't have no kaleidoscope. Haven't you heard about conspiracies before? Well, Richard Jefferson just got his old buddy with a little bit of a gag here. Richard Jefferson is wearing a flat world championship shirt, as you know, the Cavs are the world champions. Well, RJ had a flat world championship shirt made
500 years ago for Magellan. We found out that if you go straight long enough, you will just end up back where you started, which is what he did via a boat.
Well, now I like what Kyrie Irving's response was. It was that he says, I know it's a little preposterous, but he says he also found out some other things he heard in school weren't necessarily true, And that is the case. We were taught some things in school that weren't necessarily all that true, although for the purposes of being succinct, you know, no one can go to school for 12 hours a day. You kind of got to gloss over a few things. World War One, Columbus, boom.
World War One didn't matter. World War Two, Americans were perfect and nothing went wrong.
America, boom. Don't talk about Vietnam, Desert Storm, it happened, don't and then it. Columbus.
You said 1519 for Magellan? So we're coming up on the 500-year anniversary of Magellan.
Baby.
Well, what are we going to do for it? We better start planning.
Let's play some round ball. Let's play some basketball to celebrate
the roundness of the world.
Well, but wait a minute. Where do you play basketball? On a what? On a flat court?
Flat surface.
Think about it. The earth could be flat. I'm just saying. I'm not saying it's wrong. I also believe that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in assassinating JFK. He fired off six shots within a one-second span with a bolt-action rifle.
Why else would they kill him to keep him quiet?
Absolutely, man. He knew about them flat earths.
Let's talk about the 40 flat time for Jamal Williams. What does he need to run? What's a good time for a guy like Jamal Williams?
4.55. He cannot be running faster than 4.6. That was John White's problem. John White, the fourth, or Juan Blanco Cuatro from Utah, was a very good running back, set Utah's single-season rushing record, was a good player for a couple of years, ended up running a 4.7, or I think he ran a 4.8, 40 at his pro day. Obviously not indicative of his true speed, but that's what happens to some of these guys. When you don't run a 40 time that's within a certain range, NFL teams will just say, it's not worth it. It's just not worth the stress of, you know, me as a scout putting my name on you, my stamp of approval, and then having you get cut. Well, then all of a sudden that scout loses credibility. Now, no one's going to miss on a surefire prospect. There's guys that are like that. Jadeveon Clowney, for example, is that. When it comes to a guy like, remember, Rob Gronkowski was not a first-round pick. Rob Gronkowski out of Arizona was dominant, but he had about five back surgeries. And I think teams knew that his diet was 74% beer.
What's up, Boston?
They're not judging necessarily, but you've got to do your research on these guys. If Jamal Williams has a banged-up knee and kind of a lower level of competition that he's faced, and then he doesn't go out and run faster than 4.7, the hill's growing in front of Jamal Williams to get into the league, whereas if he runs 4.55, in that range, mid 4.5s or better, NFL teams will say, this guy's a steal. In the third round, you got to take the swag daddy.
So what type of running back is he when he gets to the NFL? He's not Adrian Peterson. He's not a guy you're going to rely on like that. He's not Le'Veon Bell. I mean, who will he turn into? What's the best case scenario? How many carries a game does he get?
Well, that's the thing. There's hardly any feature backs anymore.
Right.
You just listed a couple of guys who might be the last of them. Le'Veon Bell is pretty unique. I mean, he's clearly a feature back. No one's going to argue with that. I mean, Adrian Peterson is just a horrid person, and I have a feeling as soon as these immense physical gifts start to dissipate, you'll see his carries do the same. Adrian Peterson, though, he's one of the best athletes ever to walk the earth, and maybe that factors into his career long term, but that's the thing against Jamal Williams is that he is a true lead back in an era where nobody needs that. Todd Gurley is that style of back, and he's pretty unique. We can think of three or four names, but none of those teams won a Super Bowl. No, the Pats won a Super Bowl because of the thunder and lightning action they had with LeGarrette Blount and Dion Lewis.
Sure.
And in fact, LeGarrette Blount didn't play much in the Super Bowl.
Yeah, and even more so, it was James White was the guy that was a star. I mean, it was their third running back that came in and played.
And James White had seven catches or something?
Right. Yeah, you got to be able to do it all.
And Jamal didn't get to show any of that at BYU. He didn't get to catch the ball because, frankly, Taysom Hill didn't go through his reads. He looked at one receiver and then took off and ran. He did it for four straight years. Jamal Williams is going to benefit from being in an NFL system. But, again, think about all these steps you have to take as a scout to make the case for Jamal Williams. You know, if you can't watch Jamal Williams against SEC defenses, well, then how do you put him in the same category as Leonard Fournette?
Sure. Dalvin Cook.
Dalvin Cook from Florida State was just dynamic.
Even Christian McCaffrey. I mean, look at the talent he went up against.
Christian McCaffrey is somewhat polarizing even. The same teams that like Christian McCaffrey will like Jamal Williams because they've really done their research. Jamal and Christian McCaffrey have great instincts. They run with power. They get better as the game goes on. But who's got time to wait around for you to do that? What offense is going to say, well, you know, by the time the fourth quarter rolls around, man, this guy's going to be dangerous? No, it's a league full of freaks of nature making plays. Otherwise, you are just going to get beat and you are going to get replaced. Jamal Williams is a true lead back in an era where there's not a need for one. So that's why the 40 time is so important for Jamal Williams. He's got to prove that he's got that burst to go out there and just be an instant fire starter. He's got to make people miss in space.
Jamal Williams was listed as one of five running backs with the most to prove at the upcoming NFL draft, which starts a week from yesterday. He comes in at number five on the spot. He comes in behind Leonard Fournette at number one. Fournette from LSU, really just, I'm not sure his 40 time is as important as just the fact that he's out there and healthy. Dalvin Cook, I mean, I question why you would put those guys one and two on this list, because they're going to be drafted one and two overall. There's nobody else in the mix who's actually going to step up and displace those guys. So whether Leonard Fournette goes eight overall to the Carolina Panthers or falls to 11 or 12, I don't think it's really an enormous conversation. Samaje Perine from Oklahoma comes in at number three. Corey Clement from Wisconsin comes in at number four. And then at number five, you have Jamal Williams coming in from BYU. Again, these aren't rankings of running backs. These are just guys who they could do the most for themselves in the upcoming combine.
Jamal's got that track background as well. And you can't have that on your resume and then not run well. If Jamal puts the total package together, that's going to really help. But also, he's been running in this wonky offense the last few years. Robert and I's offense made sense for BYU, but it doesn't make sense in the NFL. The diamond formation is just weird. That was where Taysom Hill would be back there with Jamal Williams, with Algie Brown. There'd be three running backs back there with Taysom Hill, which means there's four total players in the backfield. If you count the five offensive linemen, that's nine players, which means you're guaranteeing yourself a nine-man box at least. If you're running the ball into a nine-man box in the NFL, you will be fired mid-game. It doesn't work that way in the NFL. Unless it's fourth and one on the goal line in the Super Bowl, you have to check out of that look. So Jamal, bless his heart, he was fighting an uphill battle. He was fighting a battle for years that most running backs don't have to face. And then last year, when he finally got under Ty Detmer, there was four walk-on offensive linemen in front of him.
We want to get you hooked up with a four-pack to K1 Speed. Stop.
Let's do a giveaway, man.
We want to get you hooked up with a four-pack to K1 Speed. Coming up here this Saturday, 10 to noon, Gunther and I are going to be hanging out along with 10 listeners with that four-pack. They're going to qualify for a chance to win the NASCAR Driveway on March 10th through the 12th. Again, the event is coming up at K1 Speed in Sandy this Saturday from 10 to noon. Gunther and I are going to be hanging out there, 725 East and 106 South. All qualifiers will have the chance to race around the K1 Speed's track, and the listener with the fastest speed will win the trip to go check out the NASCAR Driveway March 10th through the 12th. You're coming in for a timed speed on Saturday. Hang out with Gunther and I. Be the third caller through right now and get yourself qualified for the race and the four-pack to K1 Speed in Sandy. 801-483-1320, 801-483-1320. When we come back, we address the latest rumors revolving around the NBA trade deadline and the Utah Jazz. Stay tuned. Gunther and Ben.
1320 K-Fan.
Gunther and Ben.
Gunther and Ben, 1320K Fan, 544, he's Kyle Gunther, I'm Ben Anderson. The NBA trade deadline is tomorrow at 1 p.m. Mountain Time, so by the time we are on the air at 3 o'clock, the Jazz will or will have not made any moves for the final time this season.
Now, the story that broke late in our show yesterday, almost at, 6:45, almost to 7 o'clock, we start hearing that Deron Williams is clearly on the trading block for Dallas, and one of the teams interested could be the Utah Jazz. Today, Deron Williams is held out of practice, as is Andrew Bogut for the Mavericks, leading many to speculate as to where their future could be. The Jazz makes sense in a lot of ways culturally with Deron Williams. I think both parties could be interested in mending fences. Both sides need a home. I mean, Deron Williams hasn't thrived in Dallas. He clearly still enjoys the state. He spends time here in the offseason. But how about, for a starting lineup standpoint, you can't sit George Hill, but Deron Williams has really never come off the bench in his entire career, has he? I mean, he was always starting in Brooklyn. He's been the starter this year. He took a one-year $10 million deal to be a private hitman right for Dallas. I mean, Deron Williams knows what side of the bread is buttered. He's trying to get some cash, and the Jazz are going to have to pay for his services. But would D-Will come off the bench to reunite with the Jazz?
That would be one of the tricky issues with what would have to happen if he does get traded to Salt Lake, because he's not going to start over George Hill. Now, George Hill hasn't been perfectly healthy, and maybe if there is truth to some of these rumors, that he isn't totally healthy. That George Hill isn't going to be available fully for the last 32 games of the season. He's still missing games late in the season due to that toe injury. And if that's the case, maybe the Jazz need a guy who's better than capable of being a spot starter at times. And Darren Williams is that type of player. Then you say, Darren, we're going to find 30 minutes a game for you still, 28 minutes a game, basically starter's minutes. But you're not necessarily going to be in the starting lineup. But you could finish, and the Jazz could go small. And the Jazz could play a lineup where they go George Hill, Darren Williams, Gordon Hayward, Joe Johnson, and Rudy Gobert to close a game. And if they wanted to do that, I think Darren would be valuable. George Hill would be valuable there. That is something the Jazz could look at if you wanted to find a way to keep him happy. But again, you would only have him for 30 games before you'd sign somewhere else.
Was it Kevin O'Connor who said one of the biggest mistakes of his entire career was moving on from Mo Williams?
Right.
He ended up bringing him back for a year there later on in his career. It's not unprecedented, although I think it's still somewhat unlikely. I think it's much more likely that the Jazz have received serious calls about Derek Favors. I wonder if the Jazz have declined any offers, why? I wonder why there would be hesitancy to move on from Derek Favors. As a professional, we've all loved what Derek Favors has given us here in town. He was a big part of why we were able to transition so quickly from Darren Williams in the first place. But Derek Favors has been injured and doesn't fit the new scheme. Why would the Jazz have turned down any offer for Derek Favors? What role could he play over the next five seasons?
Well, because let's say Rudy Gobert goes down for a week or two. Well, you still got Derek Favors to step in and be your starting center, and he's shown an ability to play that role, and that's a guy you can rely on, well, then you just keep Boris Diaw at power forward.
But that's not his true position,
It's
center.
Not his true position, but he's better than Jeff Withey is at that spot. So,
well, come on, that's not saying Jeff Withey wouldn't make 27 other teams.
Exactly. So that's why the Jazz right now have value for Derek Favors still on their team. Now, if they could get a guy that could come in and give them actual value in return, that's fine. But if someone came in and said, hey, we'll give you a guy who's on his last legs in the NBA and a second-round draft pick, what do you think? No, turn that down. Because Derek Favors is still going to play. He's under contract, and a very reasonable contract, for the next 90 games or 110 games for the Jazz.
Yeah,
they've got him this
year
and next year.
But isn't it a square peg and round hole type situation? The Jazz need Derek Favors to step out and play more of a stretch big role. He can't do that. The Jazz don't need another banger in the paint. They've got Rudy Gobert to do that.
I agree. And for the most part, I think late in games, you're not going to see Derek Favors on the floor. I think you're going to see a guy like Joe Johnson on the floor. And Derek Favors has given the Jazz an ability to preserve him. But the truth is, he's still a more valuable player than Boris Diaw. He's a more valuable player than Trey Lyles because he still has games where he goes out at Atlanta and scores 20 and 10. And if he continues to get healthier, don't trade him now just to trade him. You know, you've got 30 games. You can get through 30 games with him on your roster. He's certainly not a cancer. He's not a guy who's going to be mad. And then you can trade him again this offseason. And he might be able to get you a first-round draft pick coming up here in June on draft day. And I think if you could do that, that would be fair for the Jazz. I wouldn't do it right now because it's a talent downgrade on this season. I would have to get a player back in season to trade Derek Favors. But if you make it through the end of the year, let's say you get ousted in the first or the second round, whatever it is for the Jazz, then I would start to majorly retool, and maybe I would take a draft pick with no actual player asset coming back.
I mean, there's no denying it would be a talent downgrade to move on from Favors to get some sort of an aging player, but the concern on the other end of the spectrum would be, what if the market for Derek Favors and all others of his position is just dwindling? And what if you'll never see the market value for Derek Favors as high as it is now? As odd as that sounds, what if Golden State, oddly enough, wins the championship this year? The league's not going to trend towards more bigs. Who's their biggest asset right now? I mean, down low, they're using Draymond Green
sure.
most of the time. You're going to see that.
They traded Andrew Bogut. Got rid of Bogut.
They moved on from the guy who was giving them their only low post presence. The league's going to continue to trend that way. And so if you are trying to make the conversation for trading Derek Favors, I know the Jazz love what he's done and he's meant a lot for the team, but the Jazz can't honestly be held captive by the five players on the planet that are willing to buy a house in Salt Lake. Yeah, great. Favors bought a house here. He didn't automatically just live in Atlanta and commute the whole time. So what? We're talking about a very important decision here this summer. If Gordon Hayward opts out and signs with another team, well, what will the last 5 years have been about? Where's the direction of the Jazz then if you can't even build around Gordon Hayward? Now, I think more than likely Gordon Hayward will re-sign, but if Gordon Hayward's hardly seen the playoffs with Derek Favors, he's not going to be opposed to moving on from that style of player as well.
Now, maybe that is another part of the reason, is that the Jazz are saying, well, let's see if we end up in a total rebuild this offseason. You have Gobert, and Gobert's going to be your guy, and he's going to be your cornerstone regardless of whether Hayward's here or not. I think, you know, Hayward's 1A, Gobert is 1B, and that's fine. He's an identity setter for the Jazz. Let's say on July 1st, Gordon Hayward signs a max deal with the Boston Celtics, and the Jazz start to realize, okay, well, Derek Favors isn't going to get us any closer to the playoffs. We don't necessarily need some of these older veterans. Joe Johnson still has value. We could trade him off. Let's make some of those moves. We know George Hill's not going to resign if Gordon Hayward's not back. Now you've got Derek Favors in the offseason to use to actually make a trade towards a rebuild. Right now, unless you're trading Derek Favors to improve your roster, I don't know why you would trade him. You could hold on to him, though, in the offseason and say, okay, we'll get an asset back because we're in a total rebuild that we were forced into because Gordon Hayward left.
I'm not saying you're wrong, but I hope that's not what's going on. I hope the Jazz don't have one of two scenarios out there, either re-sign Gordon Hayward or completely rebuild. We completely rebuilt 5 years ago.
That is the case, though. I mean, that will be what the Jazz have to do.
Are those the only two options?
Well, you're going to go back to giving – well, you're going to lose George Hill, so you lose probably two of your three best players next year if the Jazz lose Gordon Hayward. And, yeah, you're not going to move forward with just Derek Favors because he's not good enough to carry a
and
team.
And build around Jeff Withey at that point? Oh, that's inspiring. Build around Rudy Gobert and Jeff Withey in a league trending towards Steph Curry and backcourt play.
You go to Dante Exum and Rodney Hood, and then you try and trade guys
Favors. Exum, baby.
And your first-round draft picks, you either try and draft young talent or you package those guys with a guy like Favors to try and move up into the lottery and get another player.
It's an important offseason.
That's the approach, and yeah, I mean, that's what we talked about. This timeline for the Jazz that they've lined up is really dicey because if you have injuries all season long, like to George Hill, or Derek Favors, you put yourself in a situation where you don't reach your max potential in the 1 year you have to prove to Gordon Hayward that they're a team that he belongs on. Now, I personally think they've done enough that Gordon Hayward will resign, and I think Jazz fans should have confidence in that. But if they don't, understand that was kind of the lineup they laid out there, and that's what happens in the NBA now. If you lose your stars, you just go back to a rebuild, and that's just how the NBA works.
If you're left in that position, if you're the Jazz and Gordon Hayward does opt out and you see those dominoes take over and the Jazz are looking at rebuilding around Dante Exum, I think it might be time to put another shrimp on that Barbie.
Let's get to football at 50.
1320 KFAN brings you football at 50. BYU, Utah, the National Football League. Every hour at 10 till the hour, it's football at 50 on 1320 KFAN.
Football at 50, 1320 KFAN. Coaching movement in the Pac-12 never seems to stop. A couple of teams still need to make some moves coming up this offseason to fully fill out their rosters. But as we've looked at Utah and said, man, they could be at a disadvantage by not retaining the services of Aaron Roderick and not having that continuity on the offensive side of the ball. Look at every team in the Pac-12 South, with the exception of USC. It was the overwhelming favorite to win the Pac-12 South and the Pac-12 overall next season. Pretty much everyone retooled majorly on one side of the ball or the other.
I think UCLA's got some splaining to do. After Josh Rosen's now had three coordinators in 3 years, UCLA's not put him in a position to be as comfortable as possible. There's a lot of new terminology there. They ran a spread system and then a pro-style system, and you know, now they're making a change again. Jim Mora needs to win at least 8 games next year with Josh Rosen, or he is going to find himself on the hot seat. Now, the thing about USC is it seems like they've got it all figured out. Sam Darnold's the man down there now, but don't forget the reason why USC had a disappointing season last year was because they didn't realize they had Sam Darnold until it was too late. And Max Brown wasn't just a total failure, but he clearly wasn't a better option than Sam Darnold. So USC's got to replace Juju Smith on the outside. They've got to replace Darius Rogers at receiver, who is a 4-year starter. They've got to replace their three best offensive linemen, including both their tackles. So USC's the best team in the South on paper, as is the case most years. But I think UCLA is a hot mess of a team. Utah's right in the mix for that third best team in the South, because I think Arizona and Arizona State, they're going to both take a step back this year. Arizona, at least, is trying to rebuild its entire defense.
Now, Arizona needs to replace their receivers coach, their tight ends and special teams coordinator, and their cornerbacks coach. They've got some carryover, but do you want carryover from what you saw last year on that football team? They were atrocious. Arizona State loses their entire offensive side of the ball. When it comes to their coaching staff, Colorado loses most of their defensive side of the ball, including an ugly situation where they had to fire their safeties coach. Utah does replace a big portion of the offensive side of the ball because they had to get rid of Aaron Roderick, and they brought in Troy Taylor. They also brought in a new running backs coach to replace Dennis Erickson. I don't know how much replacing Dennis Erickson is hard to do day-to-day at practice, at least for the running back position. I think it's really hard to replace as far as experience and recruiting goes.
And you don't have the ability to recreate those relationships with coaches in the Miami area, really in the state of Florida, that Dennis Erickson cultivated over many generations. He'd been coaching since the 60s, really forming these relationships. So no, you're never going to build that pipeline again. But no, old Dennis Erickson couldn't travel the way he could when he was in his younger days. So that's a benefit to some extent. But I'm not sure where this notion came from that Troy Taylor all of a sudden he's got the solution. He's got all the answers. He's got the same route combos as the previous four offensive coordinators, Dave Christensen, Dennis Erickson, Aaron Roderick, obviously. These guys weren't buffoons. They were trying to spread it out and beat you with the speed as well.
More importantly than schematics is he just has the same talent that those guys had. For the most part, I'm sure Utah's gotten better in some places. Is Utah's offense more talented next year than it was this past year?
No way. No. The offensive line's going to be completely different.
Wide receivers aren't as good. Running back's not as good.
The quarterback position could be different. Maybe Troy Williams will grow and mature, and maybe he'll benefit from this scheme. But Troy Williams showed a ton of skill last year throwing the deep ball. He had issues on the underneath routes. And that's all Troy Taylor's trying to throw is underneath routes, timing routes, quick passes. That's why I think Cooper Bateman is really in play to be Utah's starter at quarterback. I think Utah's a bowl team next year, but there's just no way to throw the ball 60 times a game and not wear out your defense unless you've got a complete seismic shift that the last five coordinators weren't allowed to make.
Coming up next is Jimmer coming back to the NBA. We'll talk to former BYU Cougar Jackson Emery, his backcourt mate, when they played for the Cougars. Stay tuned. Gunther and Ben.
On 1320 KFAN.